Hi everyone, welcome back to the Pathfinder 101 podcast. This is Swanik Jakemar, and as you know, in this podcast series we try to examine different professions and career paths by talking to experts in those fields. If you're new to this podcast, I encourage you to listen to the introduction episode to get an idea for what this podcast is about. Today's guest is Mr. Brandon McMee, founder and chief sales officer at CoreWeave, a modern cloud infrastructure that makes GPUs accessible to whoever needs them. CoreWeave builds cloud solutions for compute-intensive operations that are up to 35 times faster and 80% less expensive than the large generalized public clouds. Mr. McBee completed his bachelor's degree in the Leeds School of Business at the University of Colorado Boulder and worked as an energy analyst at Bentech and as a proprietary trader in the energy sector before starting his own company. Hi, Mr. McBee. Thank you for your time. I really appreciate it. Let's jump right into the questions. For the first question, like, what did you want to become when you were a high school student? Was there anyone that influenced this decision, like a mentor or a parent that encouraged
you? No, there wasn't. I think that a lot of people do have that benefit, which is really fantastic. My process was more like I really knew that I wanted to be in a specific location than following a specific career. And that took me to Colorado. I'd say most of my like career orientation during college happened from just my friend group that I developed while I was in college. I'd say in high school, honestly, I had like very little idea of what I wanted to do professionally.
Okay. And how did your college study help you like your career?
I think it put me around people that ultimately like help expose me to various sectors and things that they were interested in. And those people, you know, came out of high school knowing what they wanted to do, right? Like they came out of high school knowing they wanted to be in investment banking or work in a hedge fund or whatever it was. And then I gained exposure to those kind of people in college. In terms of studies, you know, I had like one or two teachers, like my derivatives teacher, for example, he was influential just in building interest in financial instruments, commodity markets, which is ultimately what I went into in the first part of my career. But outside of that, I mean, you know, if you're talking about like 40 different classes, I had like maybe two or four classes that like really pushed me in one direction.
And in your answer to the question about compensation, you talked about like how you like the path of like building wealth first and then starting a business. But what exactly made you shift careers from your like hedge fund commodity trading into your current career?
Yeah. So this will be like a little bit of a longer answer. So I graduated in 2008 in the middle of the financial crisis. I had a job as a associate at a private equity firm that had a lot of exposure to the real estate sector. That quickly went under, I'd say about 6 months or so, which I guess at the end of the day was fortunate that it went under quickly rather than just dragged on forever. From there, I joined a analytics shop focused on the natural gas sector. It's called Bentech Energy, based out of Colorado. They were the leading analytics group for North American natural gas. And it was this really interesting position because you ultimately spent every day talking to investment banks, private equity groups, hedge funds, and decision makers at all of those entities about your view of market risk. And it became this really interesting, effectively interview platform. Right. So I was, you know, speaking with like some of the top investment management firms in the world in that sector and developing a relationship with these guys. And ultimately, I went to one of them and said that I wanted to work for them. And they created a position for me. And that was at a cross-commodity hedge fund based out of New York, where I covered coal, natural gas, and electricity markets. I spent about a year there and was then approached by one of my former Bentech clients. And this is why through the rest of the interview, you'll see I like hammer on developing a network. This is just one of those opportunities that came out of maintaining a network. And this is a meteorologist who wanted, had an offer to go work at a family office that managed capital to trade commodity markets. So I took that position just about a year or so after moving to New York, and that took me down to Houston, which is where I spent the next 6 years running a speculative portfolio for natural gas, electricity, and agriculture markets, and leveraged a short-term meteorological thesis to express changes in supply-demand that were driven by weather patterns across various regions in the United States. I ran about $100 million or so for that family office. I was in my mid to late 20s or so, and was able to do pretty well for myself at that fund. And during that time, I gained a really interesting perspective on, I guess, two things. One, failure and failing every day, multiple times a day, and just being wrong in trades I had on, and like the way that you become okay with that and learn from it and be able to have direct conversations with coworkers about why you think that they're wrong about something or they're right about something. It's just complete removal of ego, because you just can't have an ego while commodity trading or doing any kind of trading, because you'll get run over, your book will implode, you'll just get destroyed quickly. And that really hammered any semblance of any ego whatsoever out of me very quickly over that time frame. And the other component I gained a substantial appreciation for was risk management. That is another way to put like just decision making. But decision making when you have a substantial amount of, risk or professional opinion on the line, right? At the end of the day, like you're kind of making trades, whether, it involves a position or it involves like a decision that you're making. These are all like different risks that you're assessing. And those two variables, have been incredibly important to me throughout my career so far. But that job translated into me starting our current business, which is a cloud service provider focused on high performance compute workloads. The component that got us interested in starting that, I started this company with two other commodity managers that were running their own hedge fund at the time, was the inherent optionality and the infrastructure that we operate. We're able to take a server, in this case, it's a really high-end server that might be, very GPU focused or top of the line CPU infrastructure. And you can allocate that infrastructure across various high growth sectors. It's a very fungible resource. Like the same server, the same GPU component can be allocated to the media and entertainment sector, the artificial intelligence sector, the blockchain sector, and then the synthetic biology sector. And our thesis is that whenever our infrastructure isn't allocated to a traditional market, call it, VFX rendering, which would be like using compute resources to make a dragon from the Game of Thrones look like a dragon, it will automatically provision itself to whatever the most economic cryptocurrency there is to mine. And that allows us to drive 99 to 100% utilization rates across our infrastructure, and thus makes it a very attractive asset to operate. So kind of looping back to your question around compensation, for me, and I've like watched other entrepreneurs go through this as well, but I was in a pretty stable financial place to start a business after my trading career. That allowed the business to go through times to where it couldn't pay the founders a salary. Usually, you want to have the option if your business is not performing well or is going through a period where you have cash flow management issues, to have as many levers as possible. And for founders to be able to turn off their salary and keep paying their employees is pretty important. But if you're starting a business and you don't have that financial asset to fall back on, it makes it really challenging and incredibly stressful. And you have so much going on at the end of the day running a business that having to worry about, paying your mortgage or some other bill, like just is compounding. So that was, I think, going through that process of in my mid-20s to early 30s, just working my ass off, I guess, to build this financial asset that I could then go out and leverage to start a business with in my early to mid-30s, I thought that worked out well for me. Does that roughly answer your question? I'd be happy to talk more, you know, in terms of actual compensation, if that helps. But
I think that was a good answer.
Okay.
So I saw that you mentioned that you would strongly suggest taking a gap year before college for someone in their junior high school year, like considering a similar profession to yours. So yeah. Did you like have a chance to do a gap year or like?
What? No. I didn't. And, you know, I'm not sure I'd say it's specific to my profession, right? Like my profession, I guess, is like public and private capital management ultimately, right? Because I run a business, I raise capital for the business. And then, you know, I personally invest across hedge funds and run my own portfolio. And I've run capital previously. I think across the finance sector, I guess is how I should aggregate that. It's very challenging to just enter it or to take like a year off during it, right? Like if you follow the typical path of coming out of college, going straight into investment banking, you're throwing 100 hours a week into your banking career for 1 to 2 years, and then you're hoping to get a private equity role or a hedge fund role immediately after that. There's no time in between. And if you try to take time, you're going to be run over by everyone else immediately. I think that there are career paths like programming or software technology where you could, you know, take time off after college. I think you could potentially do the same in like in medicine, you know, although you start racking up pretty substantial costs for loans at that point, I would imagine. You're kind of just permanently in school in the medical sector until you're in your 30s. But for the finance sector, yeah, like I would encourage people to consider taking a year off or at least some time, like even just like the day after you graduate high school, take 3 months to go out and travel for a bit. Before going into college, like it's time that's very, very challenging to get back if you're on a finance-based career path.
And is there anything like particular you'd suggest to use that time for, or just like traveling the world, like you mentioned?
Traveling the world and making mistakes. I wouldn't be, you know, using that time as like an internship or something along those lines, right? Like time becomes a very valuable thing very quickly that you kind of sell your soul for in your 20s. And by the time you're in your 30s, you want that time back from your 20s. And it's not an easy thing to get your hands on. So using it wisely now, I very much encourage.
My next question is going to be about like embracing failure and stumbling forward. So you talked a lot about that in the responses.
Yeah, I think academia has this weird thing where you're judged only by your successes, right? Like, oh, you got, you know, an A on a test or a C on a test or whatever it is. Like you're not judged by how you fail and react to something. And that's like what the real world is more about, right? Like passing a test and getting an A on it. Like no one cares. People expect for you to be good at your job. But what really matters is how do you react when you fail at something? That's what I judge people on. That's what, you know, people I respect judge people on. That's how we choose leaders and organizations that I've been in. And it's this mentality of knowing that you're going to fail and then having a process by which you internalize, learn from, and move forward from that failure, from like, you know, the smallest failure up to, you know, the largest one you can imagine. Like it's just a part of life that you don't, I don't think you learn that well in academia. I think sports programs do a better job of teaching people how to embrace failure, but I think like general academic programs are really bad at it. And it's something that it has been super important to me because it's just always failing, but you just want to fail in the right direction and then you're making progress, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I noticed like a bit of emphasis on like the importance of networking and, and like, are there any particular habits or things to look for when like choosing mentors or people to maintain a connection with?
Yeah. You know, I've kind of been an advocate of not forcing relationships over time, right? Like you don't have to be friends with someone forever. There's going to be times in your life where it makes sense to, you know, have a relationship with someone and then that might fall away or it might persist, right? So I think that's kind of one component of it is not, you know, forcing those relationships to work. But otherwise, like I have like a trading setup at home. I can't really give it up. And one of my monitors has like, I think, 6 different chat applications on it. And that's, you know, I spend a decent amount of my day consistently reaching out to and carrying conversations on with people from the various sectors I've worked in. And that just affords opportunities that I just wouldn't come across otherwise. So I've found that just keeping messaging and conversations going with people in whatever format makes the most sense. But it's all about like personal marketing or marketing your own brand, like making people aware of what you're doing, why they should come to you for advice or thoughts on certain things, or like why they want to come to you if they had a shitty day and they just want to someone to listen to them or help them resolve a problem. But it's just making people aware that you're there, because it can get lost quickly, and especially if you're not, you know, working in the same office with them. And especially as, you know, remote work becomes more and more prevalent, I think it's important to maintain, you know, digital relationships with people as much as possible. That's where I've gotten, you know, each of the critical steps in my career not come from, you know, me going out and sourcing something directly. It's been from someone in my network bringing me an idea that I acted on, or an opportunity that I acted on.
And in terms of like general skills that would be useful in your profession, I've talked to some other people and they mentioned like consistently communication and the ability to write well are like really important to like whatever job that they pursue. Is that something you agree with?
Certainly on the communication side, I would always agree with that. Writing's an interesting point that I increasingly agree with. We're kind of working on an internal process right now of how to best communicate like new project ideas. And I think historically, a lot of places that's been through slide decks, right? Like through presentation format, like PowerPoints, right? And what we're finding is that the idea of using like a memo process instead, where you're forced to write an idea, put it on paper, you know, one is like a far more dense method of communication than a slide deck, right? You can fit a lot more words and ideas to a page than you can a chart. And being thoughtful and coherent in the way that you can communicate something, I think really matters, and people notice it, right? Like you can tell if someone's a bad writer, and that ultimately comes that they're a bad storyteller. And I think what you're like, maybe what you've heard from people, I would summarize more so than, you know, communicating and writing, is storytelling. Ultimately, if you're a fantastic storyteller, then you're going to be successful, because you're either telling the story about yourself, or you're telling a story of why you need to raise capital somewhere, or, you know, you're telling a story about a friend and helping, you know, someone else's relationship that they're trying to do. But being an excellent storyteller, I think, is a skill that's undervalued, but is very critical across most career paths.
And is that a skill that can be like developed, or is that just something that develops over time with more experience?
I don't know. Like that might be a thing that you're born with. That might be something you can develop. I mean, it's not like I'm taking classes on storytelling necessarily, but I do find myself doing it consistently when I'm pitching investors on raising capital for my company, and knowing how to adapt my story to a perspective that that investor might have, like whether they're a technology company or they're a debt or an equity provider. Like you're always shaping a story around what you think the other person wants to hear, I guess is one way to put that. And that ability to craft and adapt that story around that person, that's a skill set that I've learned with time. I certainly didn't learn that in high school by any means, I don't think. But if I had the ability to go back to high school and find coursework that was able to assist me with that, I probably would.
In the question about like general advice for high schoolers, you mentioned be aware that like artificial intelligence is going to be like very impactful on white collar jobs. So
yes,
could you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah. So a lot of our clients work in machine learning and artificial intelligence, and it's there's kind of this idea that it's going to be, you know, like burger flippers or pizza makers, like these machines that come in and replace jobs. And in reality, it's going to be like financial advisors. It's going to be radiologists. It's going to be these components that ultimately input that's been developed or relationships that have been developed for the last 20, 30 years, data relationships, are going to be thrown into a computer model. And those data relationships are going to create like this synthetic position that will inform what people used to do. You know, a great example of that is a company that sits on our infrastructure. They do X-ray machine learning. So they pair what radiologists said about an X-ray against the actual X-rays. And then you do that millions of times. Ultimately, you can come up with this incredibly accurate model of that process. And then all you have to do is feed it an image of an X-ray, and it'll tell you, you know, based on these millions of observations historically, this is this kind of cancer, or here's the output of it. And that's a very high paying job, radiology, that will just disappear. You might have people who operate the models and there's like a transition period, but there's going to be these sectors that disappear from white collar job employment. And you can kind of get a sense of what they are. They're typically ones that a lot of data sets get produced of. And I think that radiology is a really good example of it, but so is like a financial advisor, right? Like running a portfolio for average American families is a fairly straightforward process that has a lot of data built up around it. And you'll have these things called like robo-advisors built up and said, and then that position slowly fades away. So I think it's something that's going to be very impactful, but I think it's something that not many people understand, that it's going to be these higher paying jobs that it offsets rather than lower paying jobs. And you just need to be aware of that as you're choosing your career.
And the next question on that list was about like, how has this profession changed during the last two decades? And then you talked about how after 2008 and like the quantitative easing sort of way to remedy that situation, there's going to be like more tightening on like capital. How do you see that affecting your industry and your company?
Yeah. So there was just an amazing amount available very cheaply for the last decade. And this is speaking more to like entrepreneurship than the hedge fund sector. That capital availability made it very easy to go out and raise capital, because you have these private equity funds that would raise billions of dollars and they have to go deploy it. Otherwise, they don't collect their fees on it, right? Like the whole idea is to collect fees on capital that's actually under management, which means it has to be invested. And they were able to raise this capital very cheaply, ultimately. I think that source of cheap capital is going to be more scarce. People are going to demand more, you know, robust business plans, businesses that actually make money. It's a, you know, it's a wild concept, but I think that you're going to see more of a pivot towards growth companies that are generating free cash flow than companies that are just accreting users at any cost. And how does that affect us at CoreWeave? Like we're a CapEx intensive business, but also an asset intensive business in that we own all the infrastructure we operate. So we get to do these things called equipment financing agreements. So we have a pretty strong collateral base to get loans off of. So our cost of capital might increase a bit, but ultimately any sort of economic tightening is beneficial for us because we operate a cloud infrastructure that is cheaper and more attractive for people to scale their businesses on than other competitors in the market or doing it themselves via an on-prem installation. You know, said in other words, businesses are increasingly going to be moving to cloud services due to a scalability and affordability. And CoreWeave is really well positioned for that movement when people start saying, wow, we need to, you know, save costs. How do we save costs? And, you know, CoreWeave is in a great spot for that.
Back to one of the questions I asked earlier about like skills that are useful in your profession. Are there any technical skills, like aside from the basic Excel or Word or PowerPoint abilities?
Yeah, I've thought, and this, I think this goes back to your observation earlier on communicating. Being able to communicate with technical people has been really important in my career, which means that, like, you know, I know how to program in a few languages, but that doesn't make me a full stack programmer. It doesn't mean that, like, I would way rather go hire someone else to do programming than for me to do it. But what's helpful is I actually know how to frame conversations in a way that makes sense directly to someone who's, you know, writing code, programming, building a product, because I've worked with it before. Like I've read a little bit and I understand a little bit about it. So for me, that skill set of having at least a high level understanding of what's going on to better enable my ability to communicate has been a pretty important component in my career. I definitely, you know, encourage people to have an understanding of like how Python works and building and writing basic functions within it so that that you can conceptualize and think through the way that the other person is thinking through these problems.
And I believe I also asked you about like the statement, follow your passion. And then you said it can be sort of blinding. That changes, yeah, throughout like someone's career. But do you think it's something that can like develop if you throw yourself at something for a long time? Or do you think it's just something distracting not to worry about?
It's tough to answer, right? Like I do genuinely believe that passion changes over time and opportunity will like present itself in different ways. There certainly are people where, you know, like they've just blindly attacked a very, very specific challenge over and over and over again until it finally works. And I think that's great for them. I don't think it's a fantastic rule of thumb, though. I think it's a little bit, you know, more of just listening to yourself, trying different things, exploring different paths. You know, I kind of often think about like how absolutely crazy it is to ask someone in high school or their early years in college to figure out what their entire career path is. Like it's a crazy concept, right? Like I'm 37 and I don't even, like some days I'm not even sure exactly what it is that like I'm super passionate about or I want to be doing. I have like general ideas of it, but like it honestly does change over time. And so like my point about saying that it can be blinding to follow that is like you just have to be a little more adaptive. And like, sure, if something's really interesting for you and exciting, like, yeah, go chase it, go learn it. But it's okay for that to change over time. Like you shouldn't just be isolated to one thing because you were interested in it 2 or 3 years ago, if that makes sense.
So in your answer to the questions about like choosing your college, you mentioned that like for the first, like it's a timeline advantage for the first 2 years, you might be ahead in terms of that. But once you join the workforce, you have to like if you go to an Ivy League, you're top private, you have to maintain that lead, but you can be overtaken through like hard work.
Yeah. I should qualify that by saying, I think that statement's pretty specific to the finance sector. I don't think that applies, you know, as much to technology or medical sectors, but for finance, yes. And that goes again, back to my statement about like if you're trying to pursue a very you know, aggressive, dedicated career in finance, whether that's like entrepreneurship focused or, you know, into kind of traditional banking, wealth management, et cetera, you're sprinting for the first 6 years and it's nonstop. And you absolutely get an advantage coming out of Ivy League or privates because you get these, you get recruited ultimately by some of the leading funds in the world, and they'll get you into their analyst and associate building programs. And if you can maintain your pace and endurance, I guess, once you're within them, like you're going to be on a fantastic career path, and it's kind of like built for you. But if you don't, others will challenge you that didn't have this advantage that you had of, you know, a couple of years head start. They're going to be able to work their way up from like a Bank of America over to Goldman or whatever it may be. And then all of a sudden, then you're like, as you're a VP or something along those lines, you're going to be sitting next to a guy who's just been working his ass off. And, you know, ultimately, by the time you're in your low 30s, where you went to school matters less. Like, I don't remember the last time I looked at where someone went to school on a resume. It's just less applicable at, you know, the levels that we're hiring right now.
And in terms of like exactly what habits you practice in doing like hard work, are there any, for example, like there's this book called like Deep Work that I've just been listening to in my free time. And it talks about like locking yourself away from all distractions, not connecting to any internet or social media because these distract a lot. Are there any habits or like time management strategies you've developed that really help you achieve a very high level of work at all times?
Yeah, I'm trying to think anything specific. I mean, like in my 20s, I just never stopped. I didn't really look at things as like a 9 to 5 or having weekends. I tried to look at it as I'm working while there's something to do. And until it's done, I'm not really stopping. I still do that today. It's just today I have free time, right? Like I don't always have something to be working on necessarily. But when I do, like I'm never not going to take a call from a business partner at like 9 o'clock at night on a Saturday, right? Like I view this kind of traditional 9 to 5 Monday to Friday thing as limiting. I guess that might be because of, you know, my trading background where it was pretty much a 24/7 thing. But I just don't see a reason to have that because you end up with like all these wasted hours and traditional roles during the day at like a lot of businesses, right? Like people will go in for, you know, their 8-9 hours a day. Generally, there's not that much. You're not actually doing 8 or 9 hours worth of work. And I think the remote work environment has really highlighted that and given people this opportunity to. I find that it's really important and beneficial if you're able to maintain a strong level of fitness. You were asking about like what sort of, you know, work hacks or life hacks you have around being able like to focus and be productive. And I think, you know, being healthy and in shape is a pretty important aspect of that. Like you wake up, you feel good, you're able to have the energy to get through, you know, long work days. It just adds a little bit of more mental clarity for me at least. And if you don't maintain that in your 20s, you are faced with building it in your 30s, and you start running into this issue where you don't have the time to build it because you have a family or because your work is so busy that you can't make the time for it. And then all of a sudden it falls apart, or not all of a sudden, more slowly it falls apart. That's, I don't hear that piece of advice from a lot of people. And I wish it's something that people had told me to embrace more in my 20s.
Is there any direction you'd like to see this interview going? Like any questions that you think I haven't asked that you'd like to answer, or any final comments?
You were asking about like mentors and that kind of stuff. It was this, the concept of that was always really interesting to me and exciting to me, like coming out of college and early in my career. And I kind of found that not many people have that person. I don't know if I've ever really had a true mentor. I definitely have like older professional relationships, but like not someone I call. I'm like, hey, like, how do I do this? Or how do I think about it? Kind of more develop a little more self-reliance, whether that's good or bad, I can't really say. But more to comment that like, if that's not something you're able to identify, I wouldn't get discouraged by it, because it takes a lot of time to mentor someone as well. And it's very valuable if you do find that person willing to do it, but it's also pretty challenging to identify that person as well for that reason. Oh, I was going to say, like, I like that you guys are doing this. I think it's really interesting to be reaching out to the kind of alumni network and guys, especially like, I think for people in their like 20s, 30s or so. So it's like a little more relevant. Like if you go talk to like a bunch of guys in their 50s and 60s, it's just tough to relate, I think, because I can still remember what it was like coming out of high school and college and like having no idea what it is I want to do and those kind of fears around whether that's okay or not. And it is okay. You just keep failing forward ultimately. And those relationships and networks you develop are just super important to maintain, and going out of your way to help others does at the end of the day come back and like bring value. Yeah, I'd encourage you guys to keep finding other ways to explore these programs and reach out to other alumni. Cool. Sounds good, man.
Thank you.
All right, bye.
Thank you, Mr. McBee, for the valuable advice and for your time. And thanks to everyone who's listening for choosing to spend your valuable time with this podcast. I hope you found this useful. To get notified about future episodes, please subscribe or follow Pathfinder 101 on Twitter, Instagram, or LinkedIn. Also, please visit pathfinder101.com for more content. If the blog or podcast added some value to you, please like and share it with your friends and colleagues. Thanks, and have a great day.